Just to compliment Joe's remarks, I was told when I was walking in that we're connected to a demonstration going on right now, part of a major protests all over the world, some of them, in fact, a couple of blocks from here. But the one I was told about was in Jeju Island and off the coast of Korea, South Korea. That's the scene of horrible massacres before the Korean War, what we call the Korean War. In the last couple of years, there are plans to build a major naval base on the island, which is ecologically devastating, but from the point of view that Joe brought up, significant in that it's a highly provocative action aimed at China. It's 500, it's about 300 miles from China. It'll have nuclear submarines, aircraft carriers pointed right at China. You can imagine how we'd be acting, the U.S. would be acting if China was doing that in the Caribbean, let's say. It's part of the ongoing confrontation. It's a little odd, I think, to call it an arms race. The latest Pentagon report that I saw estimated China's military budget at, I think, a fifth of the U.S. military budget for Iraq and Afghanistan, which is a tiny fraction of the whole. And China doesn't have 800 military bases all around the world. It's not conducting international assassination campaigns. New stage yesterday. So yes, there's a confrontation, and it could be an extremely dangerous one, but it's really up to us to stop it. Well, turn to another part of the world, highly volatile and quite dangerous in its own ways and very promising too. That's the Middle East North Africa region, MENA, usually called, where the Arab Spring has been underway throughout this year. There are a number of perspectives for approaching it. I'll say a few words about each. They're, of course, closely interrelated. One perspective is from the point of view of the region itself, from what does it mean to MENA for these things to go on. And the other is a global perspective. What's the impact on what's called global order? Horrible term, because there isn't much order. It's global. What's that impact going to be? How is it developing? Well, from the point of view of the region, what's happening, actually both of these, I think, are of historic significance. The first, from the point of view of the region, quite clearly so. This is another of a long series of efforts. It's not the first time of people in the region to break away from the brutal and repressive regimes that have largely been imposed on them, sometimes often from outside, often from within. Also to break free of Western domination and open up the possibility of carving a path towards independence. Actually, these two phenomena are closely related, and that's sometimes openly acknowledged. It's worth noting. So, for example, in 1958, which was a very dangerous year in the region, a lot of things were happening. In fact, we came ominously close to using nuclear weapons then. In 1958, Eisenhower administration, President Eisenhower, raised with his staff a question. He wanted a discussion of what he called the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world. not among the governments who are fine, but among the people. So what's the reason for the campaign of hatred? Same question George Bush asked after 2000, after what we call 9/11. And in fact, the National Security Council, the highest planning body, had just come out with a study addressing that question. They pointed out that there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports or imposes harsh dictatorial regimes and blocks democracy and development. We do that because we want to maintain control over their energy resources, main resource of the region. And it went on to say that the perception is pretty accurate. And furthermore, that's essentially what we should be doing. We don't have to worry about the campaign of hatred as long as the dictators we impose and support are capable of suppressing the population. Pretty much the conclusion that was reached by the Pentagon after George Bush's plaintive plea in September 2001, when he asked, why do they hate us? And he said, well, they hate our freedom. You all remember that. The Pentagon initiated a study right at that point, Defense Science Board, and they came out with a document about it. And they corrected the president. They said they don't hate our freedom. They hate our policies, and went through the policies which they hate, which are pretty much the ones that were described by the National Security Council in 1958. And in fact, a more honest statement would have been, we hate their freedom, and for very good reasons. And we're doing a lot to prevent it, and still are. Well, it's worth remembering how far back this goes. It goes way back to the days when the ruling power was not the United States, but Britain. Up until the Second World War, Britain was the main world dominant power, never to the extent of the United States since, but of course it's extraordinary. And in the MENA region particularly, in the early 19th century, Egypt was pretty much poised to undertake an industrial revolution. In fact, its circumstances at the time were not very different from the American colonies. In both areas, the newly liberated United States and Egypt, both were rich, had rich agriculture, both had rich supplies of cotton. Cotton was the fuel of the Industrial Revolution, roughly what oil is today. It was somewhat different. The United States, as you know, had to obtain its cotton by extermination of the indigenous population and slavery and conquest of Texas and half of Mexico, and Egypt just had it. But they both had rich resources of cotton, and they both had modernizing states, which were trying to initiate programs of further development. And they both got the same advice from the rulers, from England, namely what's called sound economics. For the United States, the advice was delivered by no less than Adam Smith. He instructed the newly liberated colonies that they should follow the policies that are essentially those that the IMF and the World Bank and the economics profession recommends to the Third World today. Concentrate on, keep to your comparative advantage, do what you're good at, produce primary products, you have rich resources, produce primary products, and maybe light industry, but import your advanced industry and technology from England, which is much more advanced, and that will assure that the whole global economy does better. The same advice was given to Egypt, but in the case of Egypt, it was given with a gun behind it. The United States was liberated and was free to reject the advice, as it did, totally ignored it. It went on to violate all the principles of sound economics and became rich and powerful. Egypt didn't have the choice. The British made sure that they made it very clear that they would not tolerate a competitor in the Eastern Mediterranean, a rising industrial state, and they would use the force of the British Navy and the British financial power to destroy it, which they did. They succeeded in blocking industrial development in Egypt. Egypt ended up being Egypt. We ended up being the United States. A very striking feature of the last couple of centuries is how intimately economic and social development are linked to independence, not too surprisingly, and also how closely they're linked to violating the principles of sound economics, as they're called, holds for England, the United States, the industrial societies of Europe, Japan. It's hard to overlook the fact that of the entire South, one country wasn't colonized, Japan. One country developed, Japan. It's not a coincidence. The East Asian former colonies of Japan, recently China, it's a very striking parallel. A comparison. Anyhow, Egypt, that was attempted and failed to undertake an industrial revolution, develop to a modern society. There were many later efforts in the 1920s. There was a significant democracy movement. It's pretty much crushed by the British. After the Second World War, the United States took over from Britain, and it imposed the same policies on Egypt that Lord Palmerston, British, had done in the 19th century. Egypt was instructed, in fact, by force, that it should not undertake independent development, nothing competitive with the advanced countries, the United States. It should be complementary to them. Meanwhile, the U.S. itself continued, as the rich typically do, to violate the principles that they were imposing on the poor. The United States raised tariffs to block cheap Egyptian cotton and in other ways ensured that Egypt would follow the rules, because we force them to, but we wouldn't, because we're powerful enough to reject them, and with the usual consequences. Well, then comes, and it continues from there, 1958, Iraq broke out of the Anglo-American condominium over oil, and that was a very frightening development, a big flurry of activity and action, pretty dangerous, including what I just mentioned. The United States maneuvered to try to overthrow. There was a lot of concern that the new Iraqi government might pursue an independent nationalist course, and that's never tolerated. The British had to tolerate it in the case of the American colonies, because they had liberated themselves, but it wasn't going to be tolerated in the MENA region. In 1963, a military coup took place, which the U.S. helped to initiate, overthrew the government, incidentally initiated the career of Saddam Hussein, who was one of the victors in this. 1967 was a major event. It's generally described, and correctly, as a war between Israel and the Arab states, which is true, but there was also another war in the background, which in many respects was more significant in its implications. There was a war going on at that time between radical Islam and secular Arab nationalism. The radical Islam is centered in Saudi Arabia, for the U.S. and the West, the most important country of the region, as opposed to the oil. And it's also the center of radical Islamic extremism, center of jihadism, and so on. And rather strikingly, the U.S. and Britain have pretty consistently supported radical Islamism in opposition to secular nationalism, which is considered a much greater threat. And that's exactly what was going on then. There was, in fact, a war going on between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Nasser's Egypt was at the time the center of secular Arab nationalism, which was considered an enormous threat. The war was going on in the Yemen. Israel pretty much destroyed the main centers of secular Arab nationalism. Great boost to radical Islamic extremism, Saudi Arabia, and an enormous gift to the United States. It's at that point that U.S.-Israeli relations were established in the form they've had since. Israel proved itself as a powerful force that could control the dangerous threat of independent secular nationalism. The Nixon administration, which came in shortly after, laid out a kind of a general scheme for controlling the region. The main concern, of course, is the energy resources there to be controlled locally by dictatorial regimes, repressive regimes, but they have to be protected against their own populations. And to do that requires a kind of a police force, a set of what the Nixon administration called cops on the beat. Countries in the periphery, preferably non-Arab, that could be used to maintain the rule of the dictators. At the time, the major one was Iran. Remember, that was under the Shah, U.S. ally. So it was Iran was one, Turkey was another, Pakistan was another, provided military force for the Saudi royal family and dictatorship. And now Israel could join the group. So they were the cops on the beat. Police headquarters is in Washington. There's a branch office in London. Those two parts are not stated, but the others are. In fact, U.S.-Israeli relations have very substantially been based on similar concerns ever since. There are many others. Go into them if you like. It's coming up to the present. I won't run through the whole history. What's happening now is just another stage in a very long process. It goes way back to the early 19th century. But this time, it does look as if there will be substantial success in the MENA region in breaking out of imperial control, to an extent at least, and overthrowing at least a few of the dictatorships. The most important country is Egypt, as always, a major country in the region. And there the gains are quite real. They're limited, but real. They're limited. The reasons the demonstrations, active demonstrations, are going on regularly in Tahrir Square is that the gains are limited. But they're real. Two major gains. One is that the press is free, much freer than before, pretty free, actually. The second is, and the most important, that labor organizing can now take place. One of the most crucial aspects of these uprisings is the role of the labor movement. That's been discussed most fully by Joel Bannon. He's a main U.S. Specialist on the Arab labor movements, written a number of articles on it. And what he's pointed out, what he's pointed out is that the degree of success in the Arab Spring is very closely correlated with the level of labor militancy. And the labor militancy is not new. It goes way back, just like the efforts to overthrow dictatorships and break free of Western control. There's a substantial history of labor activism in the region, particularly in Egypt and Tunisia. Those are the two places where it's been going on longest and most successfully. And they're the two countries that have made the most gains, maybe almost the only detectable gains in the Arab Spring uprising. You know, I'm sure, that the January 25th movement in Egypt, the movement that started off the demonstrations there, is called the April 6th movement. It's described here correctly as a movement sparked by young tech-savvy professionals, which is correct, young professionals, pretty much correct. But the reason they called it the April 6th movement is because April 6th is quite a significant day in Egyptian labor history. On April 6th, 2008, there were plans for major industrial actions at one of the main industrial complexes in Egypt, the Mahalla industrial complex, to be with other actions throughout the country and organized efforts to support the labor movement. This is one, maybe the biggest of a series of such actions. Some of them had some success, limited success. The April 6th demonstrations, the biggest ones, they were crushed by force. The dictatorship crushed them, of course, U.S. support. And it's unknown here, but not forgotten in Egypt. And that's gave its name to the movement that's been the major force in the Arab Spring. It's when the organized labor movement entered the process a couple of weeks later that it really took off and became significant. It continued. There are strikes all over the country, takeovers of factories, sometimes under worker control, the formation of an independent union for the first time, and a long history of mostly repressed labor activism has really burst forth. I think that's probably a permanent victory. Well, it's not over, of course. There's a counterattack. The military in Egypt is still in control. In fact, most of the regime is still there, though weakened. It's still brutal and repressive. Similar things happening elsewhere. As far as the West is concerned, the U.S. and its allies, you'd be pretty confident they're going to do almost anything they can to prevent the rise of any form of authentic democracy and independence in the region. In part, the reasons are those that go back to the early 19th century, taking different forms at different times. But a very simple reason why the U.S. cannot tolerate a real democratic outcome, that is, one in which public opinion influences policy, is because of what public opinion is. And it's not a secret. It's not reported, barely reported, but very well known. There are U.S.-run polls in the Arab world, made public by prestigious outfits like the Brookings Institute and so on, and they're worth looking at. So in August 2010, the main poll right before all this took off, the polls showed that throughout the region, most of the Arab region, the main threat that people perceived was the United States and Israel. In Egypt, most important country, about 90% thought the U.S. and Israel are the main threat. In fact, they're so opposed to U.S. policies that about 80% actually thought the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons to balance U.S. and Israeli power. Other polls at the same time show they don't like what the Iranians are doing. They don't want them to have nuclear weapons. But in the context of balancing U.S. power, they prefer for them to have nuclear weapons. About 10% throughout the region thought of Iran as a threat. Well, these are not the attitudes that the United States wants expressed in policy. That's too obvious to comment on. So for that reason alone, you can be confident that there will be continuing efforts to try to prevent any really functioning democracy, maybe some democratic forms, but nothing that would significantly express popular attitudes. In fact, the dangers to U.S. policy from even a limited rise in democratic functioning are already quite evident. In Egypt, for the first time in 30 years, the dictator, the military regime, has been forced to permit Iranian ships to transit the Suez Canal. That's military vessels, maybe submarines. Egypt has made some moves towards improving relations, exchanging ambassadors with Iran. They have brokered a unification effort between the two Palestinian factions, Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. The U.S. is very much opposed to that, as is Israel, for many reasons. One is that the unification of the Palestinian factions would be a significant step, actually a prerequisite for moving on towards a successful attempt at independence, establishing an independent state. Another, because the U.S. and Israel for a long time, 20 years, ever since the early 90s, have been pursuing a policy of separating Gaza from the West Bank. According to the Oslo Accords, they're a single territorial unity, can't be broken up, but U.S. and Israeli policy for 20 years has been dedicated to separating them. There's very good work on this by Sarah Roy, who many of you know, the main academic specialist on Gaza, teaches at Harvard. And that policy would be threatened. The reasons for that are pretty clear. If Gaza is separated from the West Bank is essentially imprisoned, has no outlet to the outside. It's between Israel and the Jordanian dictatorship, closely allied to Israel and the U.S. And access to the outside means Gaza has to be part of it. So if they want to break that up, and also to undermine possibilities of Palestine moving towards some significant kind of independence. Now that's threatened if Hamas and Fatah, two major groups, can be brought together. It's not a simple effort, an uneasy alliance maybe, but Egypt's initiative in pushing it forward are surely not welcomed. The main concern, which is discussed pretty frequently in the press, has to do with the 1979 Egypt-Israel peace treaty. Now, the population in Egypt doesn't oppose the treaty. In fact, they're not calling for rescinding it. But they are very much opposed to the way it was interpreted by the Egyptian dictatorship in alliance with the U.S. and Israel. The peace treaty was interpreted at once and pretty explicitly as essentially giving Israel license to use force and violence in the region at will. Idea is simple. Egypt, the main military force, is eliminated by the treaty. There's no deterrent. Israel can now move on to expand its illegal settlement activities in the occupied territories and to attack its northern neighbor, Lebanon, which is exactly what they did almost instantly, using the treaty as a helpful means to achieve these ends. And so it's continued. Well, the population in Egypt doesn't like this one bit, and if to the extent that public opinion will influence policy in Egypt, there'll be pressures to change that interpretation. Doesn't mean to go to war, but to remove the license that Israel is granted, with U.S. support always, to carry out its criminal activities in the occupied territories and attacking Lebanon, which goes on regularly. The way that's described in the United States is interesting. So the New York Times, for example, described threats, any kind of threats to the treaty. There's really no threats to the treaty. There are threats to the interpretation of the treaty. They described anything of that sort as a as a threat to stability in the region, because, as they say, the treaty is the foundation of peace, of stability and peace in the region, in the Eastern Mediterranean. That's correct in a special technical sense of the term stability. The term stability is usually used in foreign policy discourse to mean subordination to U.S. orders. So, for example, when Iran tries to expand its influence in neighboring countries, that's creating instability. But when the U.S. invades and occupies them and half destroys them, that's creating stability. That's the common usage, and it's used here too. In fact, the treaty, the 79 treaty, is the foundation for instability in the region, in the literal sense of the word, not the ideological sense. As I say, it was the foundation for granting Israel license to invade Lebanon, a brutal, murderous invasion followed right away, and to expand what everyone agrees are criminal activities in the occupied territories. Well, that could be threatened if democracy moves forward, and there's a lot more. So you can be reasonably confident that, as elsewhere in the world, the U.S. and its allies will maybe support kind of formal democracy that doesn't leave the population marginalized, but not anything like a true democracy in which public opinion plays a significant role in policy formation. Well, if you look around the rest of the region, I won't run through it in detail, but by and large, U.S. policies have been entirely predictable. Where you have an oil-rich dictator who's reliable, they're given free license. They can do whatever they like. So Saudi Arabia can repress demonstrations freely, and it did so. In fact, it repressed them so severely that when the first day of rage, you know, Friday demonstration was called in Saudi Arabia, that nobody showed up because the security apparatus was so intimidating and threatening that people were afraid to go into the streets. Well, that's fine. No censure for that. Same in Kuwait. Same in Bahrain. Bahrain is the repression was so severe it even made it here. But it just gets a slight tap on the wrist, maybe, you know, clucking of disapproval, but no effort to stop it. Even when Saudi forces invaded to expedite the repression by the ruling dictators. One of the reasons is familiar, it's discussed. Bahrain is the home of the 5th U.S. 5th Fleet, the main naval force, military force in the region. The U.S. don't want that threatened. But there's another which is more significant. Bahrain is a majority Shiite island under a Sunni dictatorship. It's right across the causeway from eastern Saudi Arabia, which is mostly Shiite, and that happens to be where most of Saudi oil is. That's an inflammatory situation, particularly when you look at the geography around the northern Gulf area. By a kind of an odd accident of history, the regions where most of the oil is are Shiite-dominated. Eastern Saudi Arabia, southern Iraq, and southwestern Iran. And the idea that someday there might be maybe a tacit Shiite alliance controlling most of the world's oil and independent of the West, that's pretty frightening. So doesn't matter how much repression goes on in Bahrain, that's acceptable. With regard to the main countries, Egypt and Tunisia, the U.S. is following a game plan that is so familiar it takes real genius not to perceive it. Over and over again in past years, decades, it has become necessary to shelve a favored dictator. Can't be held any longer. Happens over and over again. Somoza, you know, Marcos in the Philippines, Chun in South Korea, Mobutu in the Congo, Ceausescu in Romania. It was the one favored communist dictator, the most brutal, the most favored, on and on. It's just a long series. It's always the same. Duvalier in Haiti, support them as long as possible. When it becomes impossible, maybe the army's turned against them, then issue ringing declarations about how much you love freedom and democracy and try to restore the old regime. That's essentially the game plan, exactly what is being carried out to the letter in Tunisia and Egypt. How much it'll succeed, we'll see. The one outlier is Libya. That's an interesting case. Libya had an oil-rich dictator, but he's not reliable. He's kind of up and back. Sometimes he does what you like, sometimes he doesn't. And in fact, U.S. policies have vacillated with regard to Libya ever since the Reagan years, ever since Gaddafi took over, in fact, and threw out the major U.S. air base. And in Libya, it's evidently has been determined that it would be better to have a more reliable government, one which wouldn't vacillate so much, which would do what we like. And so the traditional imperial powers, Britain, France, and the United States, imperial triumvirate for the region, they've initiated military action, an intervention. Actually, there were two interventions. The first one lasted about 5 minutes, and then the second one began. The first intervention was initiated when the UN resolution was passed, Resolution 1973, which called for a no-fly zone and protection of civilians. As I said, the U.S. and its allies went along with that, but as I say, for about 5 minutes. They instantly violated it and started a second intervention, the real one, which was just participating on the side of the rebels, perfectly openly. I can't even conceal it. And it had nothing to do with protecting civilians, of course. So, for example, right now, while we're meeting, the home base of the largest Libyan tribe is being pounded by NATO forces. That's not to protect civilians. And the same was true all around. Well, with regard to the first intervention, it was claimed with the 5 minute one, I think you could give an argument for that. I personally didn't oppose it. And it had a little support in the region. It's claimed that it followed a plea from the Arab League, which is only true in a very limited way. The Gulf states supported it. Most of the Arab League countries didn't participate. And furthermore, that a request from the Arab League was accompanied by another one, that a no-fly zone be established over Gaza. That one didn't even last 5 minutes. You can read about it in the British Financial Times, but not here. The second intervention, the triumvirate intervention, is almost isolated. Africa's opposed. It's an African country. The non-aligned countries are proposed. The BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, at a meeting. They happened to have a conference in China at the time. They opposed it. Even NATO is pretty tepid. Egypt, which is right next door, big military forces, not participating. Turkey kind of held back for a while and finally went along. It's a highly isolated operation. The rest of the world, almost the entire world, has been calling for negotiations and diplomacy. That was not the decision of the triumvirate. You can decide whether it's right or wrong, but in any event, that's what happened. The outcome is kind of uncertain. Libya is, even apart from outside intervention, Libya is a complicated place. There's splits between the East and the West. It's a highly tribal society. There's splits among the tribes and between the tribes and the settled populations on the coast. And those are now playing out if you follow what's happening closely. Well, there are two places that were left out of the Arab Spring. Two countries that are in the MENA region, which are under military occupation. The first is Western Sahara, second is Palestine, both under military occupation. Actually, the Arab Spring began in Western Sahara. It began last November. 10 cities in Western Sahara is the last colony. It's under UN jurisdiction for decolonization. It's the last African colony, still not decolonized. It received its independence in 1975, formally, but Morocco immediately invaded, crushed the independence movement, bitter war, brought in lots of Moroccans to settle the area, and since then there's been an ongoing conflict, not dissimilar to, in some ways similar to the Israeli-occupied territories, also rather similar to the Indonesian invasion of East Timor, which most of you know about. But that one's held, the Moroccan invasion. In November last year, there was another of the efforts to protest the occupation by the Sahrawis and to gain their legal right, formally supported right of independence. They set up tent cities and main city, same kind of things that happened later throughout the region, but it was crushed pretty quickly. Morocco's mainly a French dependency, and the French strongly supported the crushing of it, as they tried to do initially in Tunisia. The U.S. backed them quietly, and nothing's been heard from there since, except the usual protests. Well, Palestine, on the other hand, you know about. Everyone knows about. The efforts are continuing. The move to the UN last week, as normal, the United States and its allies quickly undercut the move to the United Nations. It's now kind of shelved. You know, it's going off into committees. They'll meet endlessly, come up with nothing, maybe something will happen in the General Assembly. It's possible that Palestine will get enhanced observer status, but the effort's been pretty much quashed. That the U.S. would do it is not surprising. Europe is less predictable, but if you read the court, so-called quartet, of which the U.S. and Europe are the main active entities, designated Tony Blair to deliver the message to Israel and the Palestinians that this is over. The Palestinian Authority by now, is a lot of it's just refusing to talk to Blair. They regard him as an Israeli diplomat. Of course, Israel's very enthusiastic about him. They essentially said, nothing's happening at the UN, go back to negotiations. The way the negotiations are discussed here, they're called, it's described as a conflict between two sides. Israel wants to negotiate without preconditions, and Abbas, you know, Palestinian Authority, wants to negotiate but with preconditions. Well, that's one way of looking at it. You could look at it the other way around, more realistically, and say that the Palestinians want to negotiate without preconditions, and Israel insists on a precondition, namely that they be permitted to persist with their criminal activities of taking over anything they want in the West Bank. Well, that's a precondition, except since the U.S. supports it, not in words, but in practice, we don't call it a precondition. But that's essentially where it stands. Israel and the U.S. would be very happy to have negotiations go on for the next 100 years, while Israel continues, with U.S. support, to take over whatever it wants in the West Bank, leaving, which now includes the Jordan Valley, so it's imprisoned, and leave the remaining population in essentially isolated cantons, and also, of course, to maintain the siege on Gaza, which is vicious and brutal, and just barely keeping the population at survival level, so it's not to elicit too much international protest, but nothing more. So they'll be happy to go on with negotiations indefinitely as long as they can continue with these preconditions. That's essentially what's involved. Well, very quickly, what about just a couple of words on Second aspect, what about the global significance of this? I think a useful context to look at it is the context of what, by now, kind of fashionable theme of what's called American decline. The last couple of years, a lot of talk about American decline, which is true, it's happening. But we should bear in mind that the decline dates back a long time. The United States reached the peak of its power in 1945. In 1945, the U.S. had about half the world's wealth. The U.S. had gained enormously from the Second World War economically. Industrial production had practically quadrupled. Even before the war, it was far and away the richest country in the world. Competitors were either devastated or destroyed. The U.S. had an incomparable position of security, controlling the entire Western Hemisphere, both oceans, the opposite sides of both oceans. Nothing like that in history. That was a peak of power that's never been equaled, probably never will be again. And there were plans made. Planners understood all this. They had plans as to how to organize this entire region to be essentially under U.S. domination developing or not developing along lines that fit U.S. policies. Well, that didn't last long. By 1949, it already suffered a very severe blow, an event that's called, interestingly, the loss of China. It's an interesting phrase, which is always used. You can only lose something that you possess, obviously. But this is universally called the loss of China, and it's not even discussed because it's such an obvious truism. So yes, the U.S. lost China, became independent in 1949. That's a major step. I won't go through the rest of the story, but pretty soon there were fears about the loss of Indochina and on. You know what that led to. So it continues. I mean, in fact, the system has been eroding ever since. A major blow took place in the last 10 years. The U.S. lost South America. That's not small. The Western Hemisphere has always been considered the backyard, you know, our little region over here, as the Roosevelt administration described it. Nobody touches that. That was the theme of the Monroe Doctrine in 1823. It couldn't be implemented then. The British were too powerful, but over the years became implemented. Well, in the last 10 years, for the first time in its history, 500 years since the European invaders, Latin America has actually moved successfully towards integration and independence. There have been earlier attempts, just like Egypt, but they've been crushed. This time it succeeded. It's a very significant development, what happened in Latin America the last 10 years. Without going into it, now the rot is spreading to the MENA region. There's a serious threat that the U.S. may lose that region. Now, that's not small. That from the 1945, that was considered, understood to be sort of the core of global control. Latin America is important, but nothing like the Middle East energy resources and strategic position. That's threatened now, meaning threatened by independence and democracy. And that's not going to be treated lightly, you can be sure of that. But that's major conflicts that are brewing and will continue to. Well, in general, the world is simply becoming more diverse. There's no other super. I don't think that China's a rising superpower. There's other spectacular growth and so on, but there's a lot of huge problems. But the world is becoming more diverse. There is a China-based regional organization, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which includes Russia, Central Asia, India, Pakistan, and Iran are observers close to it. It denied observer status to the United States, and it's developing as an independent, mainly energy-based region alliance, moving in other directions, which could someday turn into a counterpart to NATO, excluding the U.S. What are called the BRIC countries, mainly India, Brazil, and South Africa, called the IBSA countries. They're forming a bloc. There's a lot of interaction among them. Policy. They can't apply their policies. They're not strong enough. But they're taking pretty strong roles in the world. BRICS, even much more so. I mentioned in regard to Libya, but there's a lot more. Well, in general, the power is just becoming more diffused in the world. And that means a more turbulent world, lots of dangers. Afghanistan and Pakistan, as the UN just reported that last year in Afghanistan was the worst year of violence since 2001. It's been increasing. The U.S.-Pakistani relations are becoming extremely tense, and that could lead to a major conflict with all kind of horrendous consequences. Obama's global assassination campaign and JSOC special operations campaigns are extending all over the world. General conclusion, I think, is that there's lots on the agenda for peace movements.